This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Chi. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Today is our last episode of 2022. And before we start the episode, I just wanted to remind every one of our listeners that Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle are doing their very first joint seminar called True to Life, where you can find more about that on www.truetolife.us. It's going to be some really interesting topics. I know that the first time, Dr. Lyle, you mentioned that book, How to Find Freedom in an Unfree, or Finding Freedom in an Unfree World, I thought just the title itself was just unbelievable. As a genetic libertarian, I am. And so, Dr. Hawk, I know you've said that this theme is going to be around How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World Revisited. And so, today's show, so we're really looking forward to that. And, your seminar coming up, it's February 19th, www.truetolife.us to sign up. You can do it virtually and, you'll have replays afterwards as well. So in today's show, we are going to be just kind of, doing some small talk, Dr. Hawk, is that right? Or some, maybe not in small talk, just we're not going to go over any deep questions today, at least not ones from listeners, but we'll save that for next year.
I love that I'm associated with small talk. That's very flattering. Thank you.
That sounds about right.
it's a girl thing.
Yeah. All right, Nathan, did you have some end of year observations?
Well, you know, I've actually, the only thing I can say is that it just seems like the craziness that's been happening, that started in 2020, with all this stuff, it seems like, I don't know what direction we're going, but it seems that it's not going in the wrong direction anymore. Although I may not be privy to certain information, but, I was actually curious what you guys are looking forward to in 2023. I know we have the seminar coming up. Anything else that you guys are working on? Maybe a book or something or two?
Well, yeah. Yes, certainly. What comes to mind for you, Jen? I got plenty of things I could say, but roll it.
I love that we actually have this this event on the books to hang out in person. And it's also a real, like, we're excited about it, not just because we get to hang out and do something in person, which is sort of novel in this post-COVID world. We haven't seen each other since, 2020, but also because it's, it's a chance for us to kind of let our right brains roam a little bit on both the content and the book. So this is an opportunity for us to get together and work on the book, which of course I know another year has come and gone where we sort of had a tentative release date, and I'm going to have to update the website again.
Sure.
And say, coming sometime in 2023. But the thing with the book and with everything that we work on collaboratively is that everything that we do is sort of, greater than the sum of its parts. We synthesize together when we talk about stuff. It's sort of like we don't know where we're going to go when we're on any given topic and we're trying to solve a problem. We talked a little bit about this in the last show, actually, and it's really interesting. So I'm excited about being able to kind of tackle some of the themes in the book and figure out how we're going to wrap that up. To everybody who's asked about it, I get questions about it all the time. It's kind of not a problem of not having enough at this point. We've written so much. It's actually more a question of getting it edited and getting it together and, tying it all up with a nice little bow. We don't have a tremendous amount left to actually write. So it's a good bet that will come to you in the next year. But in the meantime, we have lots of things to think about and to, you know, just wonder about and put our heads together and figure out how we can bring different perspectives to the same puzzle. And that's always a really rewarding process. And so doing the seminar series is a way to do that in a slightly more structured way, where we can have different lecture topics and play around with new ideas. And it's sort of like a laboratory for new EP thinking for us. So that's super exciting.
Yeah.
Since we're both academic refugees and don't have an academic conference to go to, this is kind of what we're doing instead.
Yeah. I can't remember. I was reading something. I've lost it, but I was reading something EEP related, and I can remember having multiple thoughts about it, which is that I was frustrated that I could tell that the people were writing it were not problem solving clinicians. And it's like, okay, you're very smart and you theoretically know what I know, but actually that's not true. You know 75% of what I know. And the 75%, the 25% that I don't know what you know is not probably useful. And the 25% that I know that you don't know is unbelievably useful, because that's all the ways that I solve problems when people talk to me. And so very often looking at and reading academical stuff is kind of interesting to me at this point. But what's way more interesting is if you and I just try to solve problems. That's way more interesting. In other words, I've got a colleague that's a clinician that the two of us, when we start solving problems, we have this feeling. Well, what's nice is that there's nothing more useful than someone who knows something or has a perspective that you don't have. It's just unbelievably important. I was thinking back on the whole concept of collaboration and how important it is to when I think back of almost any major project that I've ever done, it always had a collaborator of some kind. And part of that is that when you hit problems that you don't know how to solve, you can let your brain work on it, but somebody else may be able to solve it almost instantly because they've got perspective or knowledge or, you know, experience, or they're not intimidated by some aspect of it that you are. So it's pretty interesting to me that that, you know, so many of the things that you see in the world were as a result of a couple of people or two or three people, but often two, you know what I mean, that really collaborated tightly so that they could have all kinds of conversation. We'd go back and forth and essentially cover each other's gaps and then, you know, synergistically move things forward. Anyway, that's Lennon and McCartney, you know, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. You know, this is, you know...
Jen Hogg and Doug Lyle.
Well,
yeah, I was going to say it was sort of a self-aggrandizing.
No, it's not self-aggrandizing. It's a principle that people.
It is a principle.
Yeah, and so I think that, you know, an awful lot of people have found that anybody that's ever started a business can know the feelings of that there's a bunch of stuff that you don't know, and to have somebody else be able to lift a burden off of you, and so that your mind doesn't have to sit there and get stuck in something. And they're like, no, I know how to do that. Don't worry about that. It's like, wow, you know how to do that? Thank God. I don't have to think about that. I can go back to thinking about the other things. So anyway, that's...
And it's not even... It can be sort of a knowledge gap or a experience gap, but it's also just a perspective difference.
Yes.
You know, there's so many times where we're looking at the same thing and you just look from a slightly different angle and have a different perspective, and that, you know, allows the right brain to churn in a different way and figure it out. This is, we talked a few weeks ago, I can't remember if it was here or one of the other, might have been Perverse Incentives, but we talked about Bruce Charlton, who is one of my favorite bloggers, who's way too Christian for you to appreciate, but... is a very smart guy. He's the former editor of Medical Hypotheses,
mm-hmm.
And just a very, very interesting, very rich, outside of the box thinker, and he's written prolifically. And one of his books is called "Not Even Trying: The Corruption of Science" or something like that. And he tells a story of you know, what science really is this enterprise of collaboration among single-minded, crazy people in search of truth.
Yeah.
It's like we got to figure out how to get this airplane in the air. We got to figure out, you know, what makes this thing work, or we got to solve this issue. And it's this sort of we're facing a common problem. We're bringing different knowledge bases and also perspectives to bear on the situation, and we're all in on, you know, what we have in common is that we're trying to solve the same problem collectively. We're not bringing in a bunch of egos. We're not bringing in a bunch of funding. We're not bringing in a bunch of, there's status in the mix, because status is always in the mix, but it's just a wholly different enterprise than what you have and what science becomes over the centuries in the story that he tells, which is, you know, now the last refuge of bureaucrats, basically.
Yes,
and that
right.
the incentives have changed completely, so it no longer incentivizes this sort of single-minded, kooky, I'm going to figure it out no matter what, with any kind of set of instruments and hypotheses and anything goes kind of idea, and
yeah.
we're just going to tinker around with stuff in the basement until we figure it out. Now you have an incentive structure that, you know, rewards people who follow the rules and who report to their funders and who you know, cite their sources in a way that keeps them in the peer review pipeline, and so everybody's just sort of circling back and approving each other's work, and it's just this whole different process than how it starts. And so, yeah, I think in that sense, collaboration is, we're trying to hearken back to how, you know, humans actually solve problems.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a great book. He's a great guy, but, you know, he's very pro-Jesus.
That's fantastic. That reminds me, I mean, of so many things, but I'm you know, early social psychology was all born out of Kurt Lewin, and he was the one that set up the notion of, if you're going to try to figure out what people would do, actually, his big intellectual opponent in life was Freud, where Freud's notion was the reason why they're doing things is because of their deep-seated personality, quirky, weird shit that happened because of their traumas in childhood. So Freud's notion was the notion that people did things the way they did things because of their personalities, and they had the personalities that they had because of their traumatic experiences. So Lewin's attitude was that the reason why people are doing things is that they are they are interactive with their environment. And so he didn't, so he was, so what happened was, in the history of psychology, it got cleaved down the middle between, quote, personality theory, which was, you know, the reason why they're doing it is because of their personalities. And the other side was, no, the reason they're doing it is because of the situational forces. And obviously, both are true, but these were really opponent views at one time, and still remain that way significantly. But the opponent view, I mean, the ultimate is that the flagship journal of the of those fields in psychology today is called the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. I mean, it's kind of interesting that that's true. But what Lewin did was he set up little experiments and then watched people do things. And so he set up weird, funny-looking things. And so many of the great experiments that drew me, you know, into really gave me respect for academic psychology were social psychology experiments that were done in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, things like the Milgram study. Milgram was absolutely a intellectual child of Kurt Lewin. And Solomon Asch with the Asch studies of the lines on the chalkboard. And then all these kinds of things like have 10 people stare up at the roof and then watch other people stare up at the roof. you know, bystander intervention studies of Darley and Latané, where you have, you know, smoke in a room and, you know, a guy just sits there not caring, and the subject is like, wait a minute, he's sniffing around looking at the guy that's just sitting there calmly while there's smoke in the room. Like, geez, if that guy isn't moving, maybe I shouldn't be moving. So all this kind of interesting, but the reason I'm talking about this stuff is that I believe back in those days, those were the early academicians of a legitimate scientific process where they were trying to figure things out. And now we have garbage.
Yeah, we have worse than garbage.
Yes. Yeah. Worse than garbage. Yeah.
In psychology and in political science and
right.
Every discipline you can shake a stick at.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's because the same process has infested all of these disciplines.
Yes.
And they all have these sort of like glory days where, you know,
right.
People are and that was kind of the vision I had of what grad school was.
Right.
You know, you sit around with your mentors and you have this intergenerational exchange where they are the old guard and they have these you know, old ideas that are still fundamental and useful, but the fresh air comes in and breathes new life into them, and the synthesis occurs, and it's just this miraculous academic process, and everything's great, and everybody just, you know, just loves it. And
yeah.
Has a wonderful time.
Right, right.
And of course, that's not what it is at all. What it is this sort of race to the bottom with funding and with the 10-year clock and with staying in line and finding your niche that is somehow distinguishing yourself within fundamental conformity.
Yes.
So you're definitely walking the party line. You're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing, but you're doing it in just you've got a little special sparkle that makes you.
Yes.
And
right.
And you're the one who, you know, oh, you wrote that great paper on such and such, but really your paper doesn't say anything fundamentally new or challenging or difficult or confronting about anything, because if it did, it would never pass peer review. It would never see the light of day, or your committee, if you're in a graduate program, would just not allow you to advance if you were too far out of line. So, and that's how it's built. It's built to work that way, and it's just absolutely disastrous for inquiry.
Fundamentally corrupted by public money,
and it's public money's at the end of the day.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I became acquainted with that as soon as I started to take some federal grants, some National Science Foundation grants, and some, you know, it was a different deal when it was small money, department money or private funders. But as soon as you start to get on the federal dole and the reporting requirements and just how you have to pitch your research in order to receive the funding at all, it has this pervasive effect where you start to think about your whole project differently. You start to value different aspects of the research. You start to plan the research differently. I mean, it just infiltrates the method and the whole endeavor of the thing. And that is discipline wide, and not just in political science. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's why, now that's actually great, because now people, of course, people that have heard us and find value in what it is that we say, maybe they sort of know this, because probably the vast majority of people that are listening to us are people that probably have at least pretty significant bachelor's degrees. You know what I mean? Even if it was something as watered down as sociology or psychology, they were probably pretty serious about it because they're pretty smart, or they wouldn't be listening to us. So they would recognize the feeling and the sense of excitement and wonder at something new. And if you haven't gone through and gotten a major league graduate degree from a major institution, you don't know just what sludge it is.
Yeah.
And I can remember reviewing my advisor's grants for NIH, you know, reading them over and seeing what I thought, you know, trying to edit it here and there. And I remember thinking, it's just total garbage. Here I am, this little, you know, libertarian, looking at this like, this is unbelievable. This is how much money? And whatever it is, $500,000 or whatever the heck it was at the time. And I'm thinking, well, located down in there is my $6,500 for the year.
So you better sign off on it. Yep.
You know, yep. That's, but I mean, just thinking, this is just completely useless. And my guy was a very decent guy. He was just an absolute poster child for what you're supposed to be.
And, sure, you know, it's not that the people aren't decent. They're perfectly decent, but they've been shaped by the system.
Yes.
And the soul has been driven out of their work.
They're
just bean counters.
Yeah, well, what's worse is that the I would argue that a lot of people there where I was didn't have that much chops. In other words, they...
And, well, that's a whole parallel process. Yeah. But yes, that's very relevant, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the people with the chops didn't stick around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very depressing environment. I mean, you think about trying to tackle... I mean, I think part of the problem is that there's no longer any such thing as really a public intellectual, you know, sort of somebody who knows a little about a lot of things and can kind of integrate different frameworks and theories to creatively look at problems and share those interpretations of those problems with other public intellectuals who are also, well, you know, I've got a grounding in the classics. I've got a little knowledge of chemistry. I've got a little knowledge of that. I've got like this well-rounded education. And so that makes for just more creative problem solving in general. So that doesn't exist anymore because everyone was driven into the academy and became more and more these insular little kingdoms where, you know, everything is just an echo chamber for what is acceptable within that discipline. So if I were to try to write like an explicitly evolutionary psychology informed treatment of some big political science problem, I could do it, but I would have to do it using a different literature. Like I couldn't be bringing in David Buss, and I couldn't be bringing in, you know, sort of the EP literature, because that's psychology. It's a whole different discipline. That's not our world. It wouldn't go through peer review. Peer review would check it and say, well, this sounds like you're trying to talk about, you know, rational choice theory, and so you need, you know, bring in Axelrod, or you need to treat this within our paradigm and follow our rules for how we talk about this problem. You're not allowed to deviate too far outside the lines on that. And so it's just it's this huge constraint on just how you think is how you talk is how you think, and how you think is how you solve the problem. And so if you're surrounded by people who are forcing you to communicate in a certain way using certain literatures, treating those literatures in a certain way, some things are, you know, just accepted as debunked, or you know, we don't take that seriously, then you can't bring it back in and give it a new treatment because it's just been drummed out of the discourse. So all of these things contribute to this bureaucratic cesspool of no free inquiry whatsoever. And it's depressing. That's why most creative polymaths depart the academy with alacrity. Go find each other elsewhere.
all grand. So there's nothing like I'm hoping, actually, one of the things that we hope is in doing our little seminars that we meet some of you, and we're going to be able to have conversations with some of you that were hanging out over the next year, because we plan on several of these where we get to meet, you know, 10, 15, 20 people. And that will be interesting to do. But it's also great for us to be taking questions and be together and be trying to solve them and sort of challenge our minds. So... yeah. Plus, just walking the backwoods of Virginia and talking, that's going to be good too. So
yeah.
But we actually look forward to this year being a little bit more out of the closet. In other words, a little bit more out there, reachable with folks. And as we're getting ready to then take our book out to the world. And there we hope to meet more people and have more conversations so that we can do exactly what what Jen's talking about, i.e. our own independent academy process.
Yeah. Yeah. And not in a formal way. I mean, I think that there are quite a few people out there who are trying to mimic the university model and create kind of a parallel university model. And I think some of those projects are really exciting. And I know a lot of very intelligent people are involved with those at different levels. You know, the Jordan Petersons and the Steve Pinkers and the Bretton Heathers. And there's definitely interesting stuff going on, but that's not really what we're trying to do. We're just trying to create space where we can speak freely and, you know, cover a lot of ground and tackle interesting unsolved issues that affect real people in real lives, which is also something that academia is not really great at doing.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of free speech, Dr. Hawk, I know something I wanted to ask if there's something that you didn't expect that would happen last year that actually did happen. So one of the things for me was I did not expect Elon Musk to take over Twitter and then reveal everything that he's been revealing in the last few months. I'm just wondering, just a little segue towards Twitter. What are your thoughts on that, Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle? And also, is there something that you expected that you didn't expect would happen that happened?
Oh, well, there were lots of things, lots of things that were expected that didn't happen and not expected that did. The whole Elon thing, you know, I still don't know quite what to think. My spidey sense tingleth that he's just not entirely to be trusted. I really want to trust him. And I think what he's doing right now is definitely, you know, a net good for the moment. For sort of non-specific and mostly just woo-woo intuitive reasons, I've been so burned by free discourse over the past couple of years, and I just have a lot of trouble seeing him as this white knight who will solve all of our free speech problems. And also because he's been a little inconsistent even since he's taken the helm and done these rollouts. And the way that he's rolling out the so-called Twitter files, you know, which people who are very online are familiar with what this is, but he's been sort of very specifically curating and dribbling out a specific perspective on what, on sort of the collusion between social media and specifically Twitter and the federal government in the pandemic era, revealing some pretty amazing, shocking things, most of which are not particularly shocking to those of us who have had a front row seat to this and have been suspicious all along. But, you know, that the CIA, in addition to other alphabet agencies, was directly intervening with Twitter brass to censor and downgrade accounts that were, for example, declaring anti-war sentiment toward Ukraine. So, you know, that was enough for the CIA to step in and say, shut down that account. And certainly all of the deep state agencies were very involved in the COVID communication suppression. So we basically had an idea that that was going on. It's apparently worse than we knew, which is also not that surprising.
Yeah.
But the way that this is being handled, it's this bizarre, like it's being dripped out with various so-called independent journalists, some of whom are not that independent and who are problematic in their own right, with capital P, problematic, use woke language. And it's an interesting stable of people that he's chosen to represent these things. And I don't know how much of that is just that he's trying to walk a middle path and kind of choose people who are equally offensive to everybody, or a diversity of people who, you know, some people are going to like some of them and other people are going to like others. I can't tell what's going on. What disturbs me about it is, okay, he's opening, you know, it's this glasnost sort of process where let's open the doors and let's throw light on the truth and let everybody sort it out. But he's doing it in a very specific, curated way. You're allowed to see these screenshots. You're allowed to see this information that, you know, Barry Weiss is going to tell you this story with these Slack conversations that I've given her access to present it in a sort of specific way, rather than just like a big WikiLeaks drop, for example. Mm. If you did the big data dump, jump and you let all of the independent journalists tackle it and sniff out whatever they find is relevant and write their own pieces analyzing it rather than whatever's going on here. I mean, Matt Taibbi was in his email to his subscribers right before the first drop, he said things like, you know, it's been a crazy week and I've had to sign all kinds of disclosures and I've had to agree to specific terms and yada, yada, yada. And that stuff just makes me very nervous. It's like, why are we being... If we're in the interest of opening the curtains and showing what's really going on in the sausage factory here, then why are we not like opening it fully up and letting everybody see it without any sort of moderation or, you know, content direction? So those kinds of things keep me edgy as far as Elon goes. But I definitely do appreciate that he's there. It's certainly an improvement on what it's been. I mean, and people always say, oh, well, Twitter, it's, who cares about Twitter? It's only 1% of Americans on Twitter or whatever it is, which is true. But Twitter is where... you know, the Overton window is managed. It's like Twitter defines the terms of the national conversation because all of the elites are there. All of the opinion makers are there. Certainly every journalist is there. And so it's a very important space to sort of negotiate and redefine the parameters of what we're allowed to talk about, what's off limits, how we talk about things, how, you know, what's the conventional wisdom around topic A. And so it's very important in that regard. And so whoever's managing it is relevant. And all of this is a very important moment. I just don't know where it goes and I don't know what the end game is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dr. Lyle,
but it
is
nice that, you know, people who were suspended are coming back and you can sort of speak freely there again without fear of getting summarily dismissed.
Yeah. I mean, certainly what we've learned has been complete, total confirmation of all the big, quote, conspiracy theories.
Every conspiracy theory is, even Elon, there's a clip going around saying, he's like, well, basically every conspiracy theory about Twitter turns out to be true. And so it's like, and so not just conspiracy theories about Twitter, but about, you know, government interference in COVID discourse, in Ukraine discourse,
in all political discourse.
Yes. And this is not just the Biden administration. It goes back to the Trump administration, especially with the COVID stuff that just came out today. This all starts with the Trump administration. So it's been illuminating and sort of gratifying to be like, well, yeah, my tinfoil hat picked up that signal accurately. And we've been right about that for sure. But at the same time, that's the other piece of it that really bothers me is the dribbling out. They literally do these dumps usually on a Friday or Saturday when just, you know, only absolutely insane people are hanging out on Twitter on, you know, Christmas weekend, watching the COVID file Twitter dump. It's like, okay, well, who are the people who are paying attention?
I feel personally attacked.
Well, I was there too. It's okay. But I think what it does is it's like the opposite of the big splashy front page New York Times or Guardian article revealing, you know, mass surveillance or Watergate. It's like rather than have journalists work diligently on a big project over a long period of time where they comb through everything and then put together an interpretation of reality for the masses, this is like a miniature version of that because it's not a full data dump. It is still curated. It's still interpreted by the journalists, but it's put out in like Twitter thread form, which is terrible.
It seems like it's a sign of the times, though. Like nobody's going to sit and read a seven page article, right? Just the attention span just isn't there.
Is that it? Is that what it is? Is that people?
That's what I thought. It's just they're just adapting to their audience. Is that they probably have metrics saying the average person is only going to read something, you know, this long and this short at these peak times, and so I don't know.
You're probably right about that, which is really depressing. I guess I come from, you know, more of an old school sort of like, let me sit down with the Sunday Times with this, you know, multi-page spread with all of the receipts.
With a cup of tea chino or something.
Exactly. Yeah, maybe we've moved on from that in our attention deficit world. So, yeah. Yeah, but I hate reading Twitter threads. I think most people do, especially when they're released kind of in real time. So you're sitting there like refreshing the page, like, what's he going to say next? Like, what's going on? And then it's kind of, there's been some anticlimactic moments. And so I think that's driven people away as well. And the whole thing's just, it's just odd. It's just odd. It makes me paranoid, but I'm extremely paranoid at this juncture.
Dr. Lau, what about you? What's your take on this, on everything?
Well, I think that the thing that I've learned is that there is this. I probably heard the phrase. I mean, Jen had roll her eyes, but I probably only heard the phrase "deep state" 2 or 3 years ago, and so to me, I was, you know, I'm like, well, whatever. I could understand that the deep state was. That whatever they're calling it, sort of the entrenched interests of Lockheed and Martin. Yeah, in other words, okay, yeah, I know who these people are. They need it. They're basically a big version of my advisor at University of Virginia with his grant. It's just a bigger version. In other words, he's after his $500,000 and Lockheed Martin is after, you know, $250 billion. It's like, okay, well, it's all fair. Ultimately, it's a bunch of people that are doing things that the free market wouldn't pay for, but everybody, a bunch of people are getting paid $150,000 a year for, and then some people are getting paid a whole lot of money for. And it's worth having lobbyists in Washington, and you know, maybe we need it and maybe we don't, but whatever. I can remember back as a teenager, it coming out that, I don't know, there's like a toilet seat on a jet or something.
Yeah, and I remember this.
You remember that one? It was like a $200,000 yeah. toilet seat. And
someone must have made a real big, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like, definitely a talking point.
Yeah, it was like a Golden Fleece Award or something, like, hey, I'll give you a toilet for $100. You know what I mean? To me, I always knew that fundamentally, government had corruption in it, and i.e. they had a name, pork barrel legislation. So
right.
you scratch my back and we'll put the new army base in my state, and then we'll put the new unnecessary damming of the river in your state, and we'll both shake hands, and we both got, you know, 50,000 jobs in our states, and that's why we voted for the package that also puts the funny looking, you know, the super collider into Fort Worth or whatever the hell, you know, that's what it was. And we all look at that and sort of shrug our shoulders and don't think too much about it. This is totally different. This is finding out that all of these alphabet agencies, CIA, FBI, the core of the United States government is literally acting in collusion with big tech, basically telling big tech what to do. It's not like big tech is out there with their agenda. I mean, I'm sure big tech knows quite well that their own bread is buttered wherever the people have the guns, have them, the guns pointed. And so it's like whether or not the Twitter people and the Google people and the Facebook people like who's in charge and agree with their agendas is really quite irrelevant. The truth of the matter is they do it or they're dead.
Right.
What's that saying? It's better to serve the devil than to be in his path, right?
Yeah, didn't know that saying, but boy, is that true. And so to find out that, oh my God, it was suddenly a bunch of the creepy things that I think it was probably not more than 18 months ago where I first saw one of these clips where we've now all seen them, where it shows you somebody in Scottsdale, Arizona for local Phoenix TV talking about something. And then it turns out then they clip in the person from Iowa in Des Moines TV, and then they clip in the person from Portland,
right.
Oregon.
They're all saying the same
and then pretty
thing.
Soon you got 24 of them or 48 of them on the screen, and they're all saying exactly the same phrase.
In the same cadence.
In the same cadence.
It's exactly, I mean, it's like a chorus. Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And there's many, many examples of
yes.
that. Yeah. They get their scripts straight from corporate.
This is incredible. Okay. And now we see that corporate is organizing their scripts in conjunction with the FBI.
Well, corporate's being told what the script will say by the FBI, which by the FBI, by DHS, by EPA, by the CIA. I mean, I was most disturbed by this. I mean, the idea that the CIA is instructing a speech platform to censor anti-foreign war speech is just too weird for words.
Yes.
And it's like at that point, the rabbit hole goes very, very, very deep. It's,
This is where, so the big thing that, you know, that I have had to go through is the slow and relentless discovery that no, I'm actually not crazy. As the dots start to fall on a line, it looks deep and sinister and very disturbing. And so it is. And so I saw enough dots on the line in the last 3 years to be convinced that there's been, you know, deep and powerful and nefarious forces acting against the free citizens of the United States and the free citizens of the world. And so very troublesome. These things that are coming out of Twitter now are confirmation that I have not been completely jumping off a cliff and being crazy. It's like, no, actually, I'm not being crazy. And it's just as creepy as I thought it was. And I'm glad. This is kind of like, you know, I don't know, cutting the pus open on a wound and letting it come out. It's like maybe it's going to heal.
What a perfect example.
Well, it would be if this was a true true opening Lansing. Of the door and letting the light in, but
you're
it's
right.
not. It's
right.
it's just letting a tiny bit of the pus out, which might cause bigger problems later on. you're just infecting the infection this way.
Right.
So
right.
yeah, it's I don't know quite what to make of it. Certainly whatever has been going on at Twitter is very revealing, because you can assume that as Twitter goes, so goes all of big tech.
Of course.
And, you know, people just continually ignore Robert Epstein's work on Google, but he's been showing for years how active Google will rearrange its search algorithms to nudge you in certain directions ahead of elections and in every other context. And so Google's doing it. Certainly Facebook is doing it. Every other social media platform is doing it. There's no doubt. And one of the most disturbing things in today's dump that came from Barry Weiss's org is I think David Zwig was the one who was actually tweeting it out. But there was some Trump tweet early on, summer of 2020, where he urged people not to be afraid of COVID and to kind of go out there and you know, live their lives and do whatever it is that they wanted to do and to not live in fear of the virus. So I vaguely remember the tweet. And there was a conversation in safety, in Twitter safety or Twitter, you know, whatever they call their Office of Compliance and Safety, about, you know, how is this not a violation of our misinformation policy? I.e. the president is telling people not to be afraid. We can't let that stand. we need people to be afraid. And for me, that really just sums up the whole thing. Like, that is, you know, everybody's making more money when people are afraid. Everybody's consolidating power and has more control over the population when they're afraid. That is just Machiavellian, you know, basic politics 101. So it's the idea that even just telling people to live normally and don't let fear rule your life is problematic. It gives you a tremendous amount of insight into what the hell's been going on. And that's more disturbing than almost anything else.
Yeah, there you go. So yeah, things have changed. We're now 3 years past the inception of this, and it's been an extraordinary, you know, 1,000 days. And now we're finding out we're finding out what was very disturbing looking 500 days in, which is after the vaccines got rolled out, any questioning about it, and particularly the cross-examination of the whole notion that these should be mandated. And then the force that the government came out with mandates, now this is all sort of behind most people. So, you know, they've had to back off because it's been such a fiasco. And also that COVID is now mutated to a level where it's you know, it's just, it's not impacting that many people. And so people are now able to comfortably run a CB on COVID in their lives, and the vast majority of people are running that CB and they're acting as if COVID didn't exist. So that's, or that it almost doesn't exist. So that's where most people have gotten to now, which is actually a rational derivative of what the actual facts are. So the, however, what's underneath of this is the extraordinary conspiratorial government that was involved here. This is almost incredible that the United States, being something that through a huge amount of time has had a magnificent free press, very adversarial with our government. You know, not totally adversarial, but adversarial.
I'd disagree on that. I mean, I think there was kind of a window of time where there was sort of an adversarial moment, maybe sort of like a post Nixon, you know, between Nixon and W, I think we had a pretty adversarial press. And then, you know, that was probably it. I think the Iraq War, the second Iraq War really, and the Patriot Act and 9/11, you know, put the press back on its heels into this more sort of like, well, we have to just, you don't want to question too much when national security is at stake. And I just don't think we ever recovered from that. And certainly you look at it pre-Watergate and it was pretty lapdoggy as well, you know, not really looking at any shenanigans of any administration in any serious depth or questioning the wars or anything. So, but I do think most of us grew up in this moment where it did seem like things had improved and journalism was a noble calling. That is no longer the case.
Now it's 48 of them on your screen.
Yeah,
all saying exactly little, the same thing.
Absolute, you know, boot licking toady. it's tragic. As the child of two journalists, I find it deeply, deeply tragic. Journalists who were very motivated by the Watergate era and really sought to speak truth to power. That's, you only find that in independent, you know, sort of people who will call themselves occasionally journalists, but people who were out there writing on Substack, basically, you know, spreading misinformation far and wide. Grifting the masses. That's where you find the truth.
Yeah, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, so do you, any messages that you have for our audience for this upcoming year? Any kind of words of wisdom, thoughts, you know, positive, negative, optimistic, pessimistic? What's kind of, you know, what's a good thing to think of?
Nate's like, enough anti-government ranting, you guys.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm with you guys. The thing with me is I agree completely. And Dr. Lyle knows, because we've talked politics before, but I always was more conspiracy minded. And so I always felt like I was crazy. But a lot of this stuff is like, oh, okay. The thing is, though, is what, like, as problem solvers, what can we do about it? You know, we can really only focus on our own problems and really help other people with their problems to the extent that they've, you know, asked us to that. And so it, to me, it's like, it's great to talk about this stuff, but it really doesn't further anybody's interests unless it's somebody with a platform like you guys, where you're writing a book and you're explaining these things to try to help move the needle in a different direction. So, so I don't have any problem with government at all. So, I mean, I don't have any problem talking about government conspiracies. Yeah.
No, we're actually not trying to move any needles.
Ah, okay.
So, we're both politically very independent, and as a result, our real concern is, I mean, we have different levels of concern. So we have levels of concern with human freedom per se, and the fact that we have, you know, essentially a power elite. You know, power elite that can be moving things around in very dangerous ways. So the power elite has taken a massive fortune from the United States taxpayer and pushed it into the Ukraine, into a hot war with Russia, and which we're in it. It's like, can you imagine, if you actually step back and think about what the implications of that are? The implications of that are unbelievably disturbing. Okay, so clearly, I mean, we have concerns for you know, the earth and its citizens and the freedom of those citizens and their safety. That's true, but there's absolutely nothing in the world me or anybody else can do about this. So from that perspective, you want to kind of have your eye cast on the world political situation so that you can make more potentially intelligent decisions for yourself and your family. Like that's mm-hmm. what it's about. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so I thought it was interesting. Jeff Bezos in a short interview was saying, hey, listen, basically a recession is coming and this might not be the best time to be buying a big screen TV. It's kind of interesting that he would say that.
Very interesting that he would say that.
You know, this is a man who sells you stuff for a living.
It's, well, don't buy the big screen TV. You can subscribe to Amazon Prime Video instead. That'd be a better use of your money.
There you go.
Yeah, but, he's got solutions.
Right,
He's here to help.
He's here to help. But I think that the macro landscape is, I mean, I don't think we can, I can't remember who said it, and it might have been somewhere in Shakespeare or somewhere else, but the notion is, the quote was, in short, serve, study what you most affect. And so we may be trying to think wide to look at a sort of a tide so that you understand where the tide is going and maybe why as best you can. But then fundamentally, you want to just make sure that you're not caught up in a tide going the wrong direction. That's all. Mm-hmm. So that's why actually our seminar, True to Life seminar, i.e. How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World Revisited.
That's why that's the theme.
That is why that's the theme. It's because we've had an extraordinary transformation of our own calibration, of our calibration about where the United States and the Western world's Western democracies really sat on a freedom scale. And the answer is, you know, in the context of human history, they're still very good. But in the context of where it is that we thought they were, they're really not good. And so sort of reconciling where we thought we were and where we really are, and then essentially updating one's plans and predictions and essentially preventative measures for your own life to be as impacted as little as possible. And also, in a way that we don't generally think about it, there's also opportunities probably that wouldn't exist if this were not happening. There's always, you know, you know what happened to...
Big money in the crack up.
Yeah.
It's the line from Gone with the Wind.
So running guns to Ethiopia. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. He knew how to benefit from a crisis. Totally.
I always, whenever any little crisis like this happened, and you hear about some 23-year-old entrepreneur that made a bunch of packages, you know, that you could buy for $69 to save your skin, because then it's got some beef jerky and some, you know, clean water pills. And it's like, instead, you know, then kid sells a whole bunch of them in the little 2 weeks of the crisis and makes a killing. It's like, that's pretty smart. But from our standpoint, it's about trying to get a better calibration about what the legitimate opportunities are for our futures and what are the threats. And how to sort of, you know, most intelligently lay down your own stepping stones and have some decision rules that you may use as the future comes at us. Because the future is going to be, it's going to be not only some, you know, considerably unpredictable, it could also be very disturbing. So I heard today, whether it's true or not, that in Germany, they're going in Germany, for God's sake. So this is the epitome of first world. So apparently in Germany, they're going to start to limit people's ability to charge up their cars and use electricity, etc. It's like, this is pretty incredible that they would do such a thing. So Germany has been always extremely sophisticated at their ability to create energy, and for them to now be right in the middle of this sort of very sinister, disturbing move towards limiting people's use of energy. And, oh, to be able to, oh, no, the big issue was central government control to be able to turn off the electricity in your house.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, if you, in other words, as soon as you go.
They've already done that. They've already, you know, if you've got like a smart, you know, you've got, you have smart temperature control in your house, then yeah, that's, they've certainly reserved the right to manage that from afar, even if they haven't acted on it in Europe and elsewhere. Yeah.
Incredible. So that is a, that's when you buy yourself a nice little wood stove. Install it in your house.
Well, if it's legal to burn wood, which it's not in most U.S. states for sure, it's, you know, it's, that's definitely been, and in fact, as someone who has recently been parameterizing wood stoves, as someone who has been without power for many, many, many days on end in West Virginia, and getting sort of threatening emails from the power utility saying that you better turn off your holiday lights or we're going to put some rolling blackouts on you. Like, that's literally the email that they sent Christmas Eve while we're in a power outage for the fifth day in a row, for the second time in 2 weeks. But, you know, I digress. As someone who has been looking at wood stoves, the EPA in 2020, interestingly enough, really got very draconian on their emissions restrictions for wood stoves. And so any new residence in the United States that installs a wood stove has to adhere to very specific EPA standards. And it's questionable how much this will be enforced in the wake of the Supreme Court decision. But for now, no one will sell you or install a wood stove for you unless it meets these requirements. And so they're pretty fancy stoves. You know, they have this secondary catalytic process that burns off the smoke. And so they're much lower emission, but they're more expensive. They price out people. You know, it just raises the bar for being able to install one at all. And again, almost any municipality that you're in is going to have major restrictions on whether you can burn wood at all. And it's not like you can hide it. So, yeah, it's, people are cornered in all kinds of directions. And there are all kinds of things like this. I mean, the fact that, you know, Johns Hopkins had another pandemic exercise in October called whatever it was, catastrophic contagion or whatever it was, that was, it's just the same thing as Event 201 all over again, except this time the global pandemic is particularly fatal for children and young people. And so, you know, it's the thing that I take away from everything that's happened in the last couple of years is that they, and I know that you and I differ a little on this, Doug. You have a little more optimism for the fact that people have woken up and, you know, with things like the Twitter files and the Robert Malones of the world and everybody else, that they can't quite get away with what they've gotten away with before. I'm not so sure. I think that they absolutely can and will continue to run the same playbook again and again and again and again, because as long as you have that 30% in the Milgram experiment who dial it up to 11, and you have enough people who are going along with that to get along, basically, then you can get away with it. And so I think this is my sort of pessimistic message for the new year, I guess, is that, yes, you have to hyper-focus on yourself and your immediate community, but I think there's a big process of coming to terms with and accepting the fact that we're not going back, that the new normal's here to stay, and that the you know, we're not spontaneously going to recover the America that we thought we knew in 2019. It's a different ballgame, and so figuring out how to adapt to that and thrive within that is going to be a interesting process for the next years ahead. Not necessarily a despairing one. I think there's a lot of hope and optimism and excitement in that, but it's going to be very different than what any of us are familiar with.
Yeah. In other words, we are adapting. We're going to be adapting to problems that we never predicted that we might have to adapt to.
Right.
And so that's...
Our privilege insulated us from those problems.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we are... And that's fine. We'll just, you know... We just have to face it. But it is a it's a different looking world, and now we're different. It's the same world, but we just didn't know what the parameters were, and so we've got a better feel for what the parameters are. And the parameters actually, you know, it actually a lot of it makes sense to me, in the sense that I shouldn't be surprised that major league monopoly capital has attempted to, you know, subvert freedom in their own interests, whatever those interests are. And, you know, I had a friend of mine who I did not know, you know, he and I, we were both sort of, he was a little more left-leaning, I was a little more centrist-leaning politically over the years since we were in grad school together. And then when I was explaining this to him, you know, about a year and a half ago, he goes, yeah, I was always worried about corporate world takeover. And I thought, interesting, I wasn't ever worried about corporate world takeover.
That used to be what leftists worried about all day, every day.
Yeah. So
used to be the hallmark, like, of being a leftist is that you were paranoid and skeptical of corporate power,
right,
and big pharma power.
Now it's just us libertarians.
Yeah. And now it's totally grounds for, you know, social media suspension.
Yes, exactly. So, oh well. So that's the that's the where we're headed is now. It's a little bit. It's a little bit like, I don't know, we could call whatever cancer stage it is, but if it's, you know, there was a time in the last year and a half where I was worried that we were bordering on stage 4 freedom cancer. And now I'm more like, I think it's stage 2, you know. I think it's,
you've done,
I think
some
it's
fasting
scary. fasting
and it
diet.
Depends where you are. The equivalent of fasting and diet is who's your sheriff, what's your jurisdiction, who are you banking with? You know, like, these are the questions. Like, don't, as Catherine Austin Fitz says, don't give your money to people who want to kill you. Don't be banking with Bank of America or Chase. You know, go get a local credit union or a local bank account. You know, spend cash as much as you can. Try to form connections in your actual real community and, you know, meet your farmers, et cetera. Like, these are the things that we should be focusing on. So you can very effectively manage stage 2 or stage 3 if your environment is right. But if you're eating a bunch of junk food and not getting any sleep, you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah. This is actually a really good analogy. Yeah.
That's where we're at.
Yeah. Well, it looked like it was even worse. In other words, if you were working,
and it could take a turn.
We'll put it this way: I think it was turning. In other words, if you start forcing mRNA vaccines into people, and they can't, and you're going to have passports, and you can't leave the country or come back into the country, and all the countries are going to play the same game, and pretty soon we're going to have these digital passports, and after that we're going to have digital currencies because we can't have people touching the money because they could pass this horrible thing, COVID, in it. It's like you start.
Okay, give me start all the money. I'll deal with the virus.
Yeah, where you start seeing where it is that they were wanting to go and that they were planning to go. Where they were planning to go was deep stage 3 freedom cancer, as fast as they could get there. And I feel like what happened is that, you know, for various and sundry reasons, we got backed up to stage 2. And it's like, okay, I didn't know we were anywhere near. I didn't know that we really had freedom cancer in this country. And so, but we found out that we did. And so now I look at it as, okay, we've got stage 2 freedom cancer. Jen thinks we have stage 3A.
3.5.
3.5.
It's very delicately managed and only in West Virginia.
Yeah. So I understand. And believe me, if anybody's ever talked to a bunch of doctors about a PATH report, that's exactly what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Like, one guy says, no, I think it's 2A. Another guy says, no, it might only be stage 1. Another guy says,
right.
No,
it's
I
not
actually
like
think
there's
it's stage
a definitive
4.
Marker. Yeah.
Yeah. They're all over the place looking at the same slides. So that's where Jen and I are just a pair of people kind of looking at this. But both of us are thinking, well, it's at least stage 2. And, you know, when we find out that those 100 people on the screen are all getting their script from a government approved corporate media release on not just one item, not just 10 items, but item after item after item after item in all of your news. You're getting something that's curated through the CIA. I mean, that's unbelievable, but it's true.
Completely unaccountable, completely opaque, you know, and you so many actors along the way who don't even realize that that's what's happening. You know, there's so many, you know, good faith, you know, the good Germans who are just following orders, who are just doing their jobs, who are just who think that they're, you know, doing things just like they've always done it and can't see the big picture or don't want to.
Yeah, and then the ones reporting the other ones for actually telling the truth.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. And so this is how it happens. It's one of the things that made Carrie Lake an interesting candidate as a refugee from that world who could, you know, really speak eloquently about what she had experienced on the other end of that. So, yep.
Yeah. Well, here we are.
We go. There's our rant.
Yeah, you got our we've got our stage two. It's fine. We're alive. You look at the little, you know, 86% chance of being alive in 5 years
with a wood stove.
Yeah, and boy, there's two ways to look at that.
With a wood stove. Yeah. Well, the other. I mean, there's so many unknowns too. Yeah. There's unknown. You know, the sort of worst case scenario, vaccine harm unknown.
Right.
So you know that paper I sent you today. We can talk about that in another episode. But there are some sort of X factors that could make things get real bad in a hurry that are quite apart from, you know, what government interference and speech platforms and just as is the hot war with Russia, for crying out loud, the nuclear superpower standoff and that turning in a direction that we lose control of, or any number of other issues. So you know, you can only make informed predictions and you know, plan ahead to a certain degree. And so you have to remain very much on your toes and very adaptive and very focused on yourself and your community. That's really what it comes down to.
Yep.
Wow.
All right.
Lots to think about, and a little bit brighter than it was last year, but still a little bit dim. But not impossible.
Yeah, last year was real bad. Last year, definitely, we were stage four gonna die. lights were going out this time last year. So, dark winter, winter.
The winter, and the year before that was the winter of death, right? So,
we've had two winters of deaths. Now we're in our third now. Yeah. So, yep. Good times.
Yep.
Well, the future is bright, hopefully. And we will, you know, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, I wish you a very, very happy new year. And hopefully you guys have some fun, or at least have some relaxation, whatever it is that you guys enjoy doing in prepping for the seminar, I'm sure, as well. So.
You bet. And we'll see you there, Nathan.
Nathan will be there in person. That's reason enough to go.
And if it turns out that some technical things go south on that seminar,
blame me.
It's all Nate's fault.
Yeah.
That's totally.
It'll be like the good old days.
He's our resident electrical engineer. So hey, I'm not supposed to know how this stuff works. This is you people know those things.
Well, what do you mean, you people? We can always just hit go live on Blog Talk Radio real time. If all else fails, we'll just we'll broadcast and open the phone lines.
That's it.
We get Rob from Boston.
All right,
again,
everybody.
So,
But it'll be good. So we got some planning to do, but should be really
and
fun.
You guys have planning to do, and our listeners, you have some planning to do as well. Just make sure you go to www.truetolife.us so you can register. The date is Sunday, February 19th, and it's an all-day seminar.
Indeed.
All good, Nathan.
Very good. Happy New Year, Dr. Hawk. Happy New Year, Dr. Lyle.
Happy New Year.
We'll talk to you next show.
Good. And next week our next one, we'll get back to Q&A.
Correct. Yep. And next week is going to be 294 or 295. Mm-hmm. And then the week after will be a new episode again. So we'll be back on track after that.
Fabulous. All right, Nathan. Thank you. Good year.
All right. Have a good one.
All right. Okay. All right, everybody.
All right. Good night.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.